about? It's our weekly catch-up with the National Party's Amy Adams.
Hi, Amy. How are we going?
I'm good. How are you going?
Oh, yeah, pretty good. Whereabouts in New Zealand are you today?
Back in Selwyn today. I was down south last time we spoke and it was raining, but no, it's actually a 20-degree blue sky day today.
Lovely. I think we're getting a bit of weird weather in Auckland today, so I'm not going to try and compare. I'll just wish.
Well, I heard about those lightning strikes there the other day. It sounded pretty violent.
Well, yeah, but I love me some good lightning. I mean, it shifts up the weather. It's all nice. All right, so let's jump in. National Party walkout. That's the big thing in the news at the minute. Now, what happened?
I don't know if it's the big thing.
Well, I mean, yeah, there's many things in the news, but this is one of the big ones.
It's pretty simple. We were putting pretty tough questions, pretty straight questions to the Prime Minister about the Carol Shoebreaker Centre, which is a significant issue that has been one of real public concern. She wasn't answering straight questions. Simon Bridges called her on it and said, why is she refusing to answer these questions? And the Speaker jumped in, to our view, very clearly trying to protect the Prime Minister from what was a legitimate question. I mean, the Prime Minister is a competent woman. She was perfectly able to respond. And it's not the Speaker's role to interfere. Simon made that point. The Speaker didn't like it and threw him out. And we thought it was simply time to show the Speaker that it's not for him to try and protect one side or the other. It's for him to enforce the rules of Parliament. And frankly, it's been building for a while. So there was a number of us who thought that if that was the way he was going to run question time, there was little point us being there.
Yeah. Also, I do kind of want to talk about the way Jacinda has handled these kinds of situations now and kind of in the past, where she doesn't like to talk until she has all the facts or information. Do you think that's valid?
Well, there's nothing wrong with that as a principle. I don't like to talk until I have the facts either, but this is a matter that there have been questions on just about on a daily basis for a month in the House. It has been a leading news story for a month. I don't think she can really simply say she doesn't have the facts. She's had plenty of time to get them, and I would have thought that when she personally has come out and defended the minister's handling of the matter, she wouldn't have done that unless she'd gone through all the facts.
And of course, even amongst all this, National has gained some criticism on the walkout.
What a surprise.
Yeah. but Winston Peters has called it non-cohesive, basically saying it was a drib-drab, his words, a trickle of National Party walking out, saying that it doesn't show a signified support for Simon Bridges being kicked out.
No, that's rubbish. I mean, the reality is, Laura, it wasn't planned. We didn't have a plan to walk out. We didn't know how the day was going to plan out. So it wasn't that there was some sort of structured approach. Simon was thrown out. Jerry was thrown out. And then a number of people chose to get up and leave as well. Others of us had questions in the House, and so we wanted to ask our question. I had a question that day, so I stayed, asked my question, and then left. The reality is, I just think that shows that it was an organic response from us. It wasn't some sort of planned move to make a point.
Absolutely. I'm going to jump onto the Land Corp tax submissions to the tax working group. So, of course, we've talked about the tax.
Your favourite topic, tax.
I know, tax. I love it.
A kindred spirit.
I do. I love our conversations about it. So I'm just kind of curious about your opinion. What do you think this failure to inform the Associate State-Owned Enterprises Minister about this tax submission, what do you think that suggests?
Well, we can only speculate, can't we? What I think National is saying is that it raises a range of questions about this. One of the concerns is that Land Corp put a submission in a month late, and there does seem to be, or there certainly seems to be, a suggestion that it is a submission that favours what the Labor and Greens part of the government want to see happen. And we're very interested in whether there was any pressure or suggestion from the colleagues of the Chief Executive in the Labor and the Greens parties to do that submission. It's certainly very odd that it came in a month late and effectively doesn't state the view of the farming sector at all, but states the view of the Labor and Green Party. Now, the fact that the New Zealand First Associate Minister wasn't informed, and it does seem to go against New Zealand First policy, I think, continues to raise questions around what the motivation for this was, and we're certainly going to be wanting to find out a lot more about the genesis of that submission.
Yeah, absolutely. And Shane Jones, he's come out and he says he did not agree with LandCorp's failure to report their submissions. I'm kind of curious, do you think this is potentially government trying to benefit from taxing agricultural capital gains?
Well, I think that my personal view, and you know, as I say, we've got to find out a lot more. My personal view is that this is a couple of people in LandCorp trying to curry favour with Labor and the Greens, and doing it in a way that breaks the no surprises obligations they have to their minister. I think it is an absolute kick in the guts for the wider farming sector, and certainly doesn't represent, you know, those views. At the end of the day, LandCorp is a farming entity, and if they're acting as a farming business, then you would have thought their submission would indicate that. I'll be very interested to know, for example, whether the LandCorp board signed off on and approved that submission. And I think these are the questions that have to be asked, because on the face of it, their submission does not follow the lines of what you would expect a farming business to submit. And as I say, the fact that it was lodged a month late tends to suggest to me that there's every possibility someone's picked up the phone and strongly suggested that the submission be written.
And of course, we talk about this very frequently. But including capital gains tax in this conversation has kind of been suggested as a way to reduce inequality, right? So do you think New Zealand is struggling with inequality?
I think New Zealand is not alone. I think actually if you look internationally, there has been, well actually it depends what you look at. If you look at income inequality has actually been broadly flat for quite some time, more than a decade now in New Zealand. So I don't think the argument around income inequality worsening actually bears out. It's often said, not always true. There is absolutely evidence though that asset inequality has changed and that gap has increased. But in that space, that is both a global issue. So it's not somehow because of New Zealand's policy settings or lack of a capital gains tax. What I think it is the result of, and this makes sense with the global trend, is that we're at a stage of the asset cycle where we have seen predominantly rising house prices for some time. And actually, when you look at assets, the number one thing that drives individuals' ownership of assets is their home ownership. So when you've gone through a period of rapid house price growth, it's no surprise that asset picture has changed. The solution to that, in my view, has always been what we've been talking about, which is we need to see far more houses being built so that people have more opportunity to, you know, to get into the housing market, and that was certainly the track we were on. But I think we have to remember this is the same in just about any country in the world you want to point at. So I think we've got to be a little bit careful that to sort of point to one thing and say, well, if we just had that, all everything would be sorted, because it is absolutely a global trend, and it is a stage of the asset cycle we're in. If we, you know, in 5 years' time find that asset bubble has burst, I think you'll find that inequality has come back together again.
I do struggle blaming it singularly on the fact that we just don't have enough houses. I think when it again, this is a rehashed point all the time between us, but capital gains kind of suggests that it would kind of deter people from investing, and investing in large sums of assets, right?
It's slightly sort of confusing a few things there. I mean, if you accept that the asset price or asset inequality has risen largely because of the rapid increase in house prices, which I think most economists agree, then you have to say, okay, what is a capital gains tax going to change that? And here's the thing: the way the capital gains tax is being proposed, it is not a capital gains tax on the whole residential property sector. It is a tax that will differently tax residential property in only a very small number of cases, because owner-occupied houses are excluded. Anything that's traded within a five-year period is excluded because they're already taxed in that way. And it looks now as if there'll be a carve-out for a number of holiday places as well, depending on, you know, from what I've read Michael Cullen saying, but we have to see the detail. That means that a large chunk of the residential property market isn't going to be taxed any differently, which means that it's not going to change the housing market and the growth in house prices. So to say that somehow a capital gains tax, as the government is talking about it, or the tax working group are talking about it, is going to affect that house price massive period we've had of house price growth, I just don't think is borne out. And as I said, I can point to any number of countries in the world that have had the same sort of escalation in house prices that do have a capital gains tax. So, you know, if we're saying the capital gains tax is suddenly going to address that asset inequality, I just don't think that's borne out. What I do think it will do, as I said to you, I think, last week, is decentralise savings and investment in the productive economy. And that's the exact opposite of what we should be doing.
I'm going to shift on to Maggie Berry at the minute. Now, was the news that came out about Maggie Berry surprising to you?
Yeah, it was, because I know Maggie very well, and she is a lovely woman and a very kind woman, and I simply don't believe those allegations at all. What we know is that the person behind a lot of the allegations in the media had been in an employment dispute with Maggie. Many of the claims made weren't found to be well-founded as part of that process. And yet it just seems that they can be repeated in the media and suddenly, Maggie is tried and convicted in the court of public opinion. I don't think that's proper process. Where it's been looked at through the employment process, it wasn't found to be made out. And I think Maggie has been incredibly unfairly painted in all of this.
But this does also follow two separate investigations of staff who ended up leaving Maggie Berry's office. Isn't that suspicious?
Well, I think actually there's a number of people who have staff coming and going from their offices for all sorts of reasons. I don't think that's enough to convict anyone. If you wanted to go through all of Parliament and see who had had, you know, one or two staff leave their office, that's that would be a long list of people. I think there's a bit of a sort of a rabid mob at the moment to chase down and to declare everyone a Parliament be some sort of bullying person. I don't think that's true. I think we certainly saw instances of that around Jamie Lee Ross, and there's no doubt in my mind that some of that behaviour is totally unacceptable. But I think what's happened now is there seems to be this view that, you know, therefore everyone in Parliament must be guilty of it, and all it takes is someone to point the finger and as I say, they're tried and convicted without any sort of process. I'm certainly not defending bullying behaviour, but I can tell you that Maggie Berry I know is a very kind woman, a lovely woman, and I've certainly never seen any evidence of that at all.
Well, I mean, her staff who are in support of her has said she's a very driven, standards high, a woman with very high standards. Could that potentially result in someone who is a little bit more seemingly aggressive around certain matters?
Well, you can look at it two ways. I think Maggie probably is a woman of very high work rate and high standards, and actually you'd want your MPs to be. I mean, we have we live in a pretty robust, high pressure, demanding environment, and we are expected to be high performing and have high standards. There's no question. I mean, if we get anything even a little bit wrong, you know, your profession are all over us, and fair enough. So we do hold ourselves to high standards. I think what it does suggest is that there's quite a debate to have around what is bullying and what is a proper expectation in a workplace. Now that's a sort of an eye of the beholder thing. I mean, there was a survey came out this morning that said that 30% of the staff in the Prime Minister's department feel that they'd been bullied. But when I had a look through at what the list of behaviours that they regarded as bullying, I think that's it's a live question as to whether that is. I mean, raised voices, talking over people in meetings, you know, standing too close to people, some of that stuff. I don't regard a lot of that as bullying. I guess it depends on the context. But I do think we have to draw a line between having high expectations and high standards and a high work rate. Doesn't make someone a bully in my book.
Yeah, but those kinds of behaviours, if they're done in a specific way that could intimidate someone standing very close to you, who is in a position of authority over you, who maybe isn't having a very happy demeanor, could that be seen as bullying?
Well, it all depends on the context and the situation. I lean over staff members' shoulders when we're working on a document together on the computer and we talk about how we're amending, you know, a document. I don't think that's bullying in that context, because if they were right up in their face and waving their finger and shouting and being abusive in that context, it could. I'm just saying that I think we have to be careful that we don't get us into a situation where having high standards and expectations and is perceived as bullying by people who may not want to meet those expectations.
I'm just going to shift into our I guess it is slightly political, but in Nelson there was the non-traditional Santa for the Santa Parade. And it sparked a lot of debate, and I was curious what your thoughts were on it. Did you support that kind of Santa?
To be honest, I really haven't given it any thought. I think anyone who's prepared to dress up in a Santa suit and go out and throw lollies to the kids and be cheery and give that sort of time to the community is welcome to do it. I don't have a strong view on it. It's not something that I spend a lot of time getting too worked up about one way or the other, to be honest.
Okay. I guess I'll leave it there then. Thank you so much for talking with me, Amy.
All right, Lewis. See you later.
See ya.
Bye.
The National Party's Amy Adams on 95 BFM.
The Wire.